Why did you eat the whole thing?
Because
you snuck in my room and got him and shut the door because I told you not to eat anymore. Why'd you eat so many?
I love M&M.
I know you love M&M's, but now you're going to have a tummy ache.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are.
When I have a rumbly in my tummy, the only thing that makes me feel better is listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
With the vast amount of changes happening in the world, it's almost impossible to get a clear picture of what's really going on.
We are trapped within the logic of capitalism, leaving us unable to imagine what comes next.
The Extra Environmentalist brings the perspectives of people who can see the whole picture and are ready for whatever comes our way.
Tune in to the Extra Environmentalist every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Thank you for tuning in to CITR Radio, and welcome to a special feature for the Canadian Mental Health Week. It's awareness about mental health. And coming up next, we have special features. One right at the top is produced by Rosemary Anderson, and it's regarding psychosis. Following that, we have some syndicated programming brought to you from Prince George, and that's related to Alzheimer's disease and more information in general about health. So we encourage you to stay tuned for this next hour for some very important messages, and keep an eye out for all the special events that are happening around town and around the country for Mental Health Week, all happening all this week. Thank you for staying tuned. This is CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
You may know someone living with a mental illness, your best friend's sister, your neighbor's cousin. There's something they want you to know.
I am more than my diagnosis.
I am more than my diagnosis.
I am more than my diagnosis, and at times I need your understanding.
People can and do recover. There is help and there is hope. For more information on mental health resources in your area, please call 211.
It was in December. He asked me if I would remove this computer chip from his neck with this syringe. And I said, well, I can't do it at this time. And then he said, well, I'll get a knife then. Maybe that'll work instead. And that's when I called EPI.
EPI, Early Psychosis Intervention. Does early intervention make a difference? How early is early? What is psychosis? And how can we recognize it? This is the story of two families dealing with psychosis.
He would be up, it'd be 4 a.m, and I'd get up and I'd hear him and I'd go ask him, what he was doing, and he would be having these fully animated conversations with people that weren't there. And I would ask, what's going on? What are you doing? Who are you talking to? And he's like, I'm working out scripts for my video game. I'm writing dialogue. I'm like, oh, okay, sounds fine. That's something he had done for years. So, and that was a huge one. Like, if I had just kind of called BS on that a little sooner, those are things you'll regret forever. Like, it's just one of those things. So obviously hearing voices is a big one. Not sleeping, not eating is also a big one. In his case, he just could never remember to eat, and he was struggling so hard. It took him 6 hours once to heat a can of soup. Those 2 years earlier, there were indicators like starting to withdraw, wasn't keeping in contact with his friends. His room was really messy, and he just seemed very absent-minded. So these were kind of general things that you could attribute to a lot of other things. Psychosis happens a lot to guys and a lot in those ages. Like, that's what I'm hearing statistically. It's males, and in that age group, like, say, from 18 to 24, like, right there, it seems to come on over a period of time. So at what point does it stop being maybe sort of a general psychosis or malaise of the mind into a real genuine schizophrenia? At age 12, he came to me and he said, Mom, I think I'm crazy. One day he just stuck the blue and said, Mom, I think I'm crazy. And I said, silly, we all have crazy thoughts once in a while, and there's nothing to it. life went on. And we were living in an area where there were drugs. And I know that he started smoking pot probably when he was around 13, 14. I'm a fairly liberal person. In my youth, I tried and experimented and things like that. And so, I mean, I monitored, and it didn't seem to be interfering with anything. It was on weekends with his friends, and not that often. But by about age 15, that's when we really started to see a change in his behavior. Problems were starting to arise. He was belligerent, sort of acting out, not being responsible, out more with his friends, less communicative with us. He was making choices that weren't necessarily very good for him or his home. You know, he was in school, very, very good student, amazing guitar player. That was his talent and his love, and he also played hockey, soccer, baseball, you know, like a regular kid.
I spoke to Helen Edwards, a family therapist with Fraser Health Early Psychosis Intervention Team. I wanted to know more about what causes psychosis, who gets psychosis, and why.
How we explain what causes psychosis is basically there's a genetic factor, which Epi doesn't really have a part to do with. That's where Laura Hansen comes in, and that's where all of her colleagues come in, and the UBC geneticists, and wondering where is it that we carry the gene of psychosis and mental illness. The other half of where psychosis comes from is stress. So we work on the stress vulnerability model, which basically means that the vulnerability is the genetic factors that you're born into. And the consensus right now, according to recent research, is that we all have that genetic factor. Some of us have more, some of us have less. But we all have that genetic vulnerability to mental illness, particularly psychosis in this case. The other half of it is stress. Stress is basically any changes that happen to a person's life. When we talk about clinical stress, we talk about it in a very neutral form. So it can be, we don't talk about what's bad stress versus good stress versus, you know, regular stress, big stress, small stress. Stress is basically any changes. So that could be moving from, one neighborhood to the next, or it could be moving across the world. It could be getting married, it could be having a baby, or it could mean, the bigger stuff like childhood trauma or sexual abuse or physical abuse or divorce or a new baby in the family. So stress over time builds up. And if we're looking at a person who already has a big genetic vulnerability to it, they were already at risk from the moment they were born. So it doesn't take a whole lot of stress for their cup to kind of tip over and have a psychotic episode at a very trying time, such as late adolescence, early adulthood. That's the time period where we see a lot of our clients come. That's the most common age, because that's when hormones happen. That's when, what am I going to do if my life happens? That's when, who am I? What's the meaning of life? Should I live at home? Should I move out? Should I get a job? Should I go to school? Should I get married? Should I have kids? You know, all of those things are stresses. All of those things are big stresses. So when we talk about triggers, that's what we mean.
It was like a switch went off, and he became this just very angry, confrontational person. And it was so out of character, and we thought that, you know, he's a teenager, he'll grow it. teenagers and all the attachments that come with them. We sort of saw some of the psychological things, but we thought that, you know, this is still teenage behavior. On a lot of the billboards in the school hallways, and actually on buses as well, I would see signs of psychosis sucks. And so I was curious about it, and looked into that and contacted them.
What made you curious about it?
Because there were certain behaviors he was exhibiting that were frightening. He was starting to put sort of symbols around doors and placements downstairs. He would make me watch a video and say, "Don't you see it? Don't you understand? Can't you see that?" And
you know, he'd have artwork or things that he had drawn as a child, and he would throw them, see, look at this, can't you see it now? And, you know, I would say, I'm sorry, I don't see what you're talking about. You know, I'm sorry that you feel this way, because I couldn't understand that he was seeing it at the time. It was very, very frightening. And actually, it was shortly after that that I contacted Effie. And I said, this is the situation. What should I do? You know, I attended some of the adult education series with Effie and learned that everyone had the same story. They didn't necessarily have the same outcome, but, you know, to me, the parallels were amazing. All the parents sitting around the table were describing high-achieving kids from, you know, middle-income families, at least middle-income, that were high-achieving, had, you know, gone through some process, usually with a lot of stress in their life, like school, usually post-secondary, and that's exactly his story. It was exactly that. He was out of high school for 2 weeks, started his college program because he just couldn't wait. He just wanted to get on it, and he made it through the first year fine, and then the second year, about 2 or 3 months into his second year, he just started to sort of gradually decline. He talked about suicide. He really felt that he should have died when he contracted diabetes because, you know, the natural way of life, that's the way it should have happened. We tried some antidepressants through our family doctor, but he stopped taking them. His biological father told him that he didn't need that crap. And a clinician came from Peace Arch to the house the next day. Said, yeah, there's definitely something going on there. That's not, looks like he's in the throes of some psychotic break. He was receiving strange messages on his cell phone, on television, on the computer, and that was one reason why he had burned his laptop, because he was getting messages that if he went to this concert, that they were going to kill him. And, you know, he'd see things everywhere.
We went through the early psychosis program, you know, and in fact, he had probably been suffering from psychosis, from schizophrenia for a while. We missed all of the signs for probably about 2 years, mostly because I think that there is a huge lack of education and just discussion about mental wellness, mental illness, all the way through our society. I mean, we just, you know, we don't talk about it. And so I think if we just had a better understanding of that, we might have caught on much, much sooner. Like I said, it was just a random conversation one day that made me go, oh, hey, that could be the problem. Mental illness is just, anyone who has a brain can get that.
I mean, I don't really care what other people think, but you go for walks with your family. And people walk off the sidewalk, you know, oh God, the crazies are coming, you know, this kind of thing. So it doesn't just affect your child, it affects your family, it affects your community, it affects your relationships. I know for myself, I isolated myself so much for a long time. For probably, I have to say, 5 years, I did that to myself. Because, you know, my friends would phone and all I'd have to talk about was what was happening because, you know, we were living in terror. I mean, we'd lock our bedroom door every night. We weren't sure. We were afraid to be home. We were afraid not to be home. Like, were we going to be robbed? You know, I mean, you just don't know when somebody is so unwell. Thank God for Effie because they had some great support group. We certainly made good use of that as well. And, I mean, as time goes by, you become more confident and able to deal with what's happening, but the initial burden is just so overwhelming. It's impossible to function in any kind of real normal capacity because your brain is always there. I've actually spoken on panels with young people who have experienced their first break or their second break,
and have gone through the EPI program and are doing extremely well. I think because of that journey, he is where he is now, and I call it the success in the sense that he's stabilized and he is able to get up every morning and take care of himself. He has those tools that he is continuing to use to maintain a lifestyle where it doesn't mean he has to be hospitalized or that people don't understand what he's saying because he's in the throes of some break. You know, I've talked to parents whose children have gone through the EPI program, and I have to say, their stories are very similar, but I think for them mostly is that they were able to get their child in early enough, thanks to EPI and their insight and their ability to support us as a family. It's given us the tools to be able to deal with each episode or event that has occurred in a way that hasn't destroyed us as a family. Laughter is a good medicine.
You've been listening to Psychosis in the Real World. Special thanks go to Diana and Tammy, and also to Nina Crack and Helen Edwards of the Fraser South EPI program. If you have concerns about psychosis, contact your family doctor. I'm Rosemary Anderson.
You may know someone living with a mental illness. Your best friend's sister, your neighbor's cousin. There's something they want you to know. I am more than my diagnosis.
I am more than my diagnosis.
I am more than my diagnosis, and at times I need your understanding.
People can and do recover. There is help and there is hope. For more information on mental health resources in your area, please call 211.
Pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears, while we all sob sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis a song the sigh of the weary. Hard times, come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times, come again no more. While we seek mirth and beauty and music light and gay, there are frail forms fainting at the door. No, their voices are silent, their pleading looks will say, oh, hard times come again no more. 'Tis a song, a sigh of the weary. Hard times, come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times, come again no more.
You're tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM. The last track you just heard, The Chieftains, off their brand new album, Voice of Ages. Chieftains have been around for 50 years now. 1962 is when they started things off. So that track off that album is called Hard Times Come Again No More. Special thanks to Rosemary Anderson for that piece on psychosis, following the theme of health and mental health week. We're getting into a clip produced by CFIS, which is located in Prince George, BC, and this is a regular program called Health First. This one originally aired on May 7th. It's all about Alzheimer's disease and what if there was a cure, and stress. So we hope you enjoy this next episode, and thank you again very much for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM.
Another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller, and today we're going to be talking about Alzheimer's disease. We're going to be talking with Mary Newport. Her husband had Alzheimer's disease, and she struggled to find some hope, and she did. We're going to be talking with her and her book. In the second half of the show, we're going to be talking with Dr. Michael Murray about his latest book, Stress, Anxiety, Insomnia, What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and What Your Doctor Doesn't Know. But before we do that, here's Reg with the health news.
72 Japanese NGO organizations have sent an urgent request to the UN and Japanese government urging immediate action to stabilize the Fukushima nuclear power plant Unit 4 spent nuclear fuel. The letter warned the seriously damaged nuclear fuel pool contains cesium-137, which is equivalent to 10 times the amount released at the time of the Chernobyl nuclear accident. If an earthquake or other event were to cause this pool to drain, this could result in a catastrophic radiological fire. The letter urges the UN to organize a nuclear safety summit to take up the crucial problem. The letter states the United Nations should establish an independent assessment team on Unit 4 and coordinate international assistance in order to stabilize its spent nuclear fuel and prevent radiological contamination with potentially catastrophic consequences. Recently released findings show infant monkeys given vaccines officially recommended by the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics exhibit autism-like symptoms. The study's results were presented at the International Meeting of Autism Research in London. Safety studies of medicines are typically conducted in monkeys prior to use in humans, yet such basic research on the current childhood vaccination regime has never before been done. The abstracts presented at the conference describe biological changes and altered behavior in vaccinated macaques that are similar to those observed in children with autism. The vaccines given were those recommended for U.S. infants in the 1990s and the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Rates of autism spectrum disorder among children born in the 1990s surged dramatically from about 1 in 5,000 to 1 in 150 children. Sports and energy drinks are causing irreversible damage to the teeth of teens and young adults in the United States, the authors of a new study claim. High acidity levels in the drinks erode tooth enamel, the glossy outer layer of teeth, the researchers contend in the May-June issue of the journal General Dentistry. For the study, the researchers analyzed acidity levels in 13 sports drinks and 9 energy drinks. They found acidity levels varied widely between brands and even flavors of the same brand. The effect on teeth of these acidity levels were assessed by immersing samples of human tooth enamel in each beverage for 15 minutes, followed by immersion in artificial saliva for 2 hours. Damage to tooth enamel was evident after 5 days with energy drinks, causing twice as much damage as sports drinks. And finally, consuming foods rich in omega-3 fatty acids may guard against Alzheimer's disease, new research suggests. The findings stem from work conducted among roughly 1,200 dementia-free patients over the age of 65. All underwent blood tests to assess levels of key Alzheimer's-associated protein after providing the study authors with a dietary breakdown dating back more than a year. The researchers discussed the possibility that seniors could perhaps eat their way to a lower risk of Alzheimer's in the May 2nd online issue issue of the journal Neurology. The latest study's results indicate that regardless of age, gender, ethnicity, and educational background, the more omega-3 fatty acids consumed, the lower the beta amyloid levels found in the blood. Amyloid levels are believed to be associated with Alzheimer's risk.
Well, our first guest knows lots about Alzheimer's disease, and her husband experienced Alzheimer's disease. She is a medical doctor who graduated from the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine in 1978. She's trained in pediatrics, and you worked in that area until your husband you started exhibiting the signs of Alzheimer's, and then you started doing some research in that area. Is that true, Dr. Marino?
Actually, I still work as a neonatologist, but, you know, I, at the same time, research Alzheimer's disease.
So tell us why you had to research Alzheimer's disease. What is the story that brought you to this point where you are today?
Yeah. Well, my husband, Steve, we've been married for 40 years at this point. He began developing symptoms of dementia when he was in his early 50s, 51, 52 years old. He was an accountant and started making serious mistakes and delaying tax returns and that type of thing. And then he began forgetting if he'd been to the bank and post office. And he was, you know, within a couple of years of that, was diagnosed as early on Alzheimer's disease and started on the typical Alzheimer's medications, Aricept and then Namenda, and finally Exelon around 2007. And in 2008, he had actually completely lost all of his accounting skills and couldn't really even use a calculator or do any simple math any longer, had stopped driving, couldn't prepare even simple meals for himself. And so things, you know, it looked like he was on a downward spiral. And what happened was he was screening for two different clinical trials, and these are both, one is an IV vaccine and the other an oral medication that are aimed at reducing the amount of plaque in the brain. People with Alzheimer's have plaque and tangles in the brain that are characteristic, and it was believed, at least at that time, that the plaques caused the disease. Whatever made the plaques happen caused the disease, and if you could eliminate those, you know, the person might improve. So he was screening for two clinical trials, 2 days in a row, and I started researching the risks and benefits of each of the medications. And what I found was a third treatment when I was looking online. It was called AC1202 at that time, and now it's finally out as a medical food called Axona, A-X-O-N-A. And they... In this press release, it stated that people who took this treatment, nearly half of people with Alzheimer's had improved memory testing after just one dose of this treatment, and it didn't say what it was, and I became very curious, naturally, and was able to find their patent online. There's a website called Free Patents Online, and what I learned was a great deal about Alzheimer's at that point, some things that I didn't know, and the basis of their treatment. And, you know, at that point, I learned that Alzheimer's is a type of diabetes of the brain. It's sometimes called type 3 diabetes, and that it had been shown that over several decades that a person who is going to develop Alzheimer's gradually develops insulin deficiency in the brain and insulin resistance in the brain, very much like type 2 diabetes. But it was called type 3 diabetes because people with Alzheimer's don't necessarily have type 1 or type 2 diabetes. Some do, but many don't. So this appeared to be a type of diabetes that was involving the brain itself. And you know, basically glucose is the primary fuel for the brain, and you need insulin to get glucose into the cells. And if the cells don't get glucose, they malfunction and then eventually die. And then you know, over a period of time, as you lose more and more neurons, you begin to develop symptoms of Alzheimer's. And so the whole concept behind AC1202 or Axona is looking for an alternative fuel to glucose for the brain. And back in the 1960s, it was found that when you're starving, you go into what's called ketosis. And ketosis is the basis of the Atkins diet, South Beach diet, that kind of thing. But you use up the glucose storage in your body very quickly, usually within 24 to 48 hours. And you start breaking down fat. And when you break down fat, ultimately you produce ketones, and your brain and other organs during starvation will switch over from using glucose to using ketones as a fuel. And ketones don't require insulin to get in. In fact, ketones behave like insulin when there is no insulin around, and they also act as a fuel, very similar to glucose, fueling the cell so that it can function. And also, in around that same time, shortly after this discovery in the 60s, the early 70s, it was found that if you ingest medium-chain triglyceride or medium-chain fatty acids, that your liver converts them directly to ketone bodies. So this is a particular type of oil that, as it turns out, is found in coconut oil. It's about 60% of the coconut oil are these medium-chain fatty acids. And also, I didn't know at that time, but MCT oil, it's called, or medium-chain triglyceride oil, is available over the counter, and bodybuilders have been using it for decades to try to increase lean body mass. And I was familiar with MCT oil, which is what the Axona product is. As a neonatologist, we used it in the feedings of our premature newborns back in the early 1970s. We began using it because it was very well absorbed, and it helped these little ones gain weight. And then the formula manufacturers began adding MCT oil and coconut oil to infant formulas to create premature formulas and also full-term newborn formulas. One of the other reasons being that breast milk is fairly high in medium-chain fatty acids as well. They're trying to mimic breast milk when they put together an infant formula. So,
Dr. Newport, how bad was your husband at this point? Like,
he was actually quite severe. As I said, he could no longer even do simple math, but he had a terrible problem with short-term memory, even forming sentences. He would halt, you know, during the course of trying to put his thoughts together. He couldn't keep his train of thought. He couldn't spell even very simple words such as put and out. He had a tremor in his jaw when he would try to talk, and also a tremor in his hand when he would try to eat.
And had the drugs made any, had they made any benefit? Was there any benefit to taking the drugs?
When he first started Aricept, I didn't really notice too much of a difference. With Namenda, I thought he seemed a little bit more focused, and that was around 2006. Maybe just for maybe 6 weeks or so, I noticed a difference. But we kept him on the drugs. They tell you if you stop them too suddenly that the person, you know, may worsen quite a bit, and you may not be able to get them back to their baseline if you try restarting it again. So we've kept them on those drugs. Exelon, we switched from Aricept to Exelon in 2007, and I can't really say I saw any difference from that. But, you know, so...
But this AC1202, what you found out was coconut-based, or it was...
It was, you know, extracted from coconut oil, basically, and they had conducted two different studies at this point. One was, it was 20 people, the very first study, and they came one day and they got a dose of AC1202, and on another day they got placebo, and the people doing the testing didn't know which, you know, a treatment they had gotten on which day, and they did cognitive testing, and they found that nearly half the people had improved scores on, I think it was 5 out of 7 tests that they did. So then they conducted a larger study, and it was 152 people, and over a longer period of time, and they looked at 45 days and 90 days, they did cognitive testing, and they found that nearly half the people had improved scores. And then they continued a certain subset of these people for 6 months, people who wanted to continue doing this and, you know, found that they had retained their improvement there on average.
So were you able to get any of this for your husband?
So, yeah, what happened was I was not able to get their product, but, you know, I found out it was just a medium-chain triglyceride oil. And initially I started giving him coconut oil, and it just happened that he was screening for these two clinical trials on 2 days back-to-back. And I had found this out the night before the first clinical trial. Screening, and didn't have time to run out and get coconut oil. And so on that day, there's a test called the mini mental status exam. It's a 30-point, very simple test that you and I would pass. But he scored only 14, and he needed at least a 16 out of 30 points to pass. So he did not get into that trial, and he was asked to draw a clock, and he drew a few little circles and a few numbers, just kind of scattered about, didn't look at all like a clock, really. And the doctor told me that he was actually on the verge of severe Alzheimer's at this point. And so on the way home, we went to the health food store and got coconut oil, and I researched the fatty acids to try to figure out how much of coconut oil is medium chain triglyceride, and it's almost 60%.
Mary?
And then looking at the dose of Axona, you know, it was now called Axona, it was 20 grams. That equated to 35 grams of coconut oil, which is a little over 2 tablespoons. And so on the next day, in the morning, I gave him 35 grams of coconut oil with his breakfast, and about 4 hours later, he had the MMSE test again, screening for this other drug trial, and he this time scored 18 out of 30 points, and he needed 16 to qualify, so he actually qualified for that study. And, you know, at first I didn't know if it was simply good luck or prayers answered or if it was a coconut oil, but we kept it going, and what we saw was that, whereas before he was very sluggish and he couldn't really even get a utensil for himself or find water, you know, he would come out in the morning alert and talkative. His personality came back, his sense of humor came back. Over time, his gait improved. He was walking very slowly at that point and couldn't run. Within a couple months, his gait normalized and he began running again.
Mary, we're going to take a quick break.
Okay.
When we come back, I need to. We're going to go back and ask you what happened as a result. Because it's a fascinating story.
Thank you.
This is Health First with Dave Fuller, available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
We're back. We're talking with Dr. Mary.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Project Space, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage, The Zoo Shop, and across the bridge, North Vancouver Music Gallery.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
You have to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
The Rio Theatre is your independent East Vancouver theatre, playing first-run feature films, independent film screenings, as well as live events. Every Friday night, there are featured midnight cult classics on the big screen, and no one can beat the Rio for their cheap date Tuesdays. This May, movies are back at the Rio. Fridays at 11 p.m., there's no better place to be than at the Rio Theater for classics such as Battle Royale, Purple Rain, The Dark Crystal, and Jackie Brown. As always, ticket prices are reduced for midnight movies if you arrive in costume, so dress to impress. Special events this month at the Rio include May 16th, open mic night at the Rio with East Fans Got Talent, starting at 8 p.m. Alan Doyle performing live Wednesday, May 23rd, also at 8 p.m. May 30th, get your nerd on with the live Dungeons & Dragons comedy experience. Join Vancouver's best comedic performers the last Wednesday of every month as they quest for glory and snacks in this live, improvised spectacular. Did we mention that movies are back at the Rio? For more information on all this and more, check out theriotheater.ca.
Hi, my name is Manny Malhotra, and I play forward for the Vancouver Canucks.
I've also joined another team, the Canucks Autism Network, and I hope you'll join us on April 1st as we light the cauldron in celebration of World Autism Awareness Day. Come to Jackpool Plaza and enjoy music, food, entertainment, and family fun. To learn more about the event or how you can donate, volunteer, or participate, visit CanucksAutism.ca.
This is Health First with Dave Fuller, available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
We're back. We're talking with Dr. Mary Newport. Her husband had Alzheimer's disease, or has Alzheimer's disease, and she eventually, through her research, discovered that coconut oil will make a difference for your husband and for people with Alzheimer's. Why does it work? Why does coconut oil work, and what difference have people noticed taking coconut oil and its derivatives? And because you've got a lot of testimonials as well. Your husband, as we heard before the break, had some fantastic results. What else have you noticed, and what else have other people noticed?
During the first year, he actually did get into one of the clinical trials, and it turned out to be a drug that caused accelerated worsening of the disease. And he was in a crossover trial, and we believe he was on the placebo the first year, because contrary to what the people on the drug experience, he actually went up on his, there was a test called the Alzheimer's Disease Assessment Scale. He improved by 6 points the first year, and the Activities of Daily Living Scale, which is a 78-point test, he improved by 14 points during the first year. And he also had a problem with reading, where the words on the page would shake around and he couldn't read, and that all stabilized after about 3 or 4 months, where he no longer had that problem. He was able to start running again. His tremors went away. His ability to put words together, you know, his conversation flowed much more smoothly. And he told me that the day this coconut oil started, it was like the light switch came back on. And basically, you know, what's going on with this, just to summarize again, is that the brain becomes like a diabetes of the brain, where it's insulin deficient and insulin resistant and can't get glucose into cells, and the cells die in the brain. And the coconut oil and MCT oil provide ketones to the brain, which are an alternative to glucose and don't need insulin to get in. So this is how it can help the brain function better. And, you know, basically with Steve, I felt that he went back in time 2 or 3 years, physically, maybe even further. You know, his decline has been very, very slow since then, you know, relative to where he was at before we started this. I have heard from, at this point, more than 150 other people that have emailed me, and I've heard about many others. Due to the limitations of the book, the editor said, please pick the 25 best reports that you have, you know, so that's what are in the book, but I have many more. And it's anywhere from very subtle improvements to some very dramatic improvements, such as what we experienced with Steve. And it's primarily people with Alzheimer's is what I hear from, but there are other neurodegenerative diseases where part of the brain is insulin deficient, insulin resistant, that there's a problem with getting energy into brain cells. And Parkinson's is another disease that shares this. And I have heard from probably about a dozen people with Parkinson's that feel that their symptoms have improved by taking the medium chain triglyceride oils.
Dr. Newport, you mentioned that your husband noticed a difference on the first day that he was taking coconut oil. Is it because the brain is starved of this, of glucose, or is starved, the sugars get right in there?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened, that, you know, his brain suddenly had fuel, whereas it didn't before. You know, if you think of hypoglycemia, if people are hypoglycemia, they get foggy and confused and shaky, and it just kind of reminds me, you know, the symptoms that he was having, you know, very similar to what you would experience if you had hypoglycemia. And then if you provide the fuel, then the symptoms, you know, go away. If a neuron's dead, you're not going to be able to revive it, you know. So, you know, I think the reason why, you know, someone would not be expected to go all the way back to normal, particularly from the stage that he was at, was you know, that he already had very significant atrophy in his brain, you know, or shrinkage of the brain, you know, which we could see on an MRI that was done right around that time. The interesting thing is he had gone from a normal MRI in 2004 to very significant atrophy right at the time we started this. And then he had another MRI 2 years later, and it was stable. There was no further deterioration in his MRI over 2 years of doing this, and which I think is very interesting and important.
You talk in your book about the relationship between Alzheimer's and herpes. Is that a significant relationship?
I think at least for some people, it may be the cause of, or a very strong contributor to Alzheimer's disease. There's a group in England, it's Dr. Ruth Itzhaki and Mark Wands, that have been studying the relationship between herpes simplex and Alzheimer's for more than a decade. They've been studying this, and what they have found is when they look at the autopsied brains of people with Alzheimer's and normal people, that the plaques in the brain, 90% of them contain the DNA virus, the DNA of the herpes simplex virus. And this is, you know, in normal people and people with Alzheimer's. It's just that people with Alzheimer's have much, much more of this plaque. And there's a certain genetic variant, you know, it's called apolipoprotein E4, you know, that people that are E4 are more likely to develop Alzheimer's. And they also have a much higher rate of having herpes simplex virus manifested as fever blisters, for example. So people with recurrent fever blisters, it's a herpes simplex, usually type 1 virus, that is living in the nerves, you know, that go to the face, you know, the mouth predominantly. But these nerves start deep in the brain. And you know, the way I think about it is, you know, if, you know, when you're stressed or, you know, whatever, or sick, you know, you will break out, you know, with fever blisters, and why wouldn't you also break out with lesions in your brain, you know, from the herpes simplex virus, you know, considering that's where the nerve starts.
Does the coconut oil have any effect on the herpes virus?
Yeah, the interesting thing is coconut oil has been reported to actually kill the herpes simplex virus. Huh. It dissolves the lipid coating on the virus and can kill it. It's been shown, there's about half of coconut oil is lauric acid, L-A-U-R-I-C, and it's a component of human breast milk that, when they say that human breast milk helps a newborn fight infection, that there's something in it, lauric acid is one of the things in it that has been found to fight infection, and it's in coconut oil, and it kills any number of bacteria, things like H. pylori, it kills candida, yeast, certain amoeba, and a number of viruses. Apparently, in some parts of Asia, they use coconut oil to treat HIV even, because it kills that virus as well.
Dr. Newport, if somebody in my family had Alzheimer's, or somebody in your family had Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. again, or was exhibiting symptoms of deteriorating cognitive function, what would you do, and what kind of dosage of coconut oil, and does any coconut oil work for helping make an improvement?
Yeah. Well, Steve takes usually at least 8 tablespoons a day of coconut oil, and that's a lot. Mm-hmm. We actually mix MCT oil and coconut oil. I recommend that people start with a small amount. They start with 1 teaspoon 2 or 3 times a day of either of these oils, or a mixture of the oils, and to take it with food. Some people, probably about 1/4 of people, will get diarrhea from it if they try to take too much too fast. Mm-hmm. So you start with a small amount and then increase it maybe every 2 or 3 days by that amount. We were lucky with Steve that he could handle 2 tablespoons right away, but many people can't. So, you know, I just recommend that they gradually increase it basically to their limits of tolerance. And, you know, like for a small woman, that might be 4 or 5 tablespoons a day. And a large man, it could be, you know, 10 tablespoons a day. It's just, you know, whatever you can handle. Basically, the thinking here is that the more you take, the more ketone you'll produce. That would be available to your brain then.
What percentage of people notice a difference for cognitive function with Alzheimer's disease in the studies that you've done?
I haven't actually done a formal study. You know, like the reports I receive from people, you know, I have no idea if there are people out there that had no response and they didn't, you know, contact me. I don't know, you know, of the people that have gone back with me, at least 90% have had a positive response to it.
Mm. That's fairly significant. 90% have noticed some response.
And those are, you know, basically, I tell people, you know, to let me know how their loved one responds, even if they don't, you know, that I want to know, and provide me some details. And, you know, I let them tell me, you know, what they saw, you know, what, instead of trying to prompt them, you know, what they might look for. And, you know, some people are fairly late, you know, late stage, and aren't really very easily testable, you know, for cognitive testing.
Although in your book, you talk about some people that are of late stages.
Right, and did have some improvement. Yeah. Now, you know, for example, there was one lady, her daughter contacted me. She said it took about 2 months for them to realize how much had changed, that it wasn't like from one day to the next. But this was a lady that was in bed most of the time, didn't recognize most of her family members, wasn't talking much, wasn't eating, had no appetite. And over a period of 2 months, she actually started getting back up out of bed again and recognized family and started talking again. And she actually, like one day, they were she went to the refrigerator and opened the refrigerator, and they thought she was going to get into trouble, which they often do. And she said, you know, that she was just looking for a cake that they had bought the day before, a Pepperidge Farm cake or something.
Wow.
She actually remembered, you know, something that had happened the day before. And then she started reading the newspaper again. And then 6 months later, she started knitting again. You know, her daughter said it was just an astounding, you know, over time, you know, that she had quite a wonderful improvement. And she recognized her granddaughter again. And they just had quality time with her. She ended up dying about a year and a half later of an infection. But they felt like her life had improved so much that they had some good quality time with her, you know, before they lost her.
Dr. Newport, the whole topic is fascinating, and I'm sure we could talk for an hour, but we're out of time. Mm-hmm. The book is called Alzheimer's Disease, What If There Was a Cure? It's a story of ketones. It's by Dr. Mary Newport. You have a website as well?
Right. It's www.coconutketones, K-E-T-O-N-E-S.com. And I have dietary guidelines that people can print out for free from there, and a story that I wrote back in July 2008. You know, it was a precursor to my book that people can print out and pass on to others, and all kinds of information on there.
Thanks, Dr. Newport. It's been great.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Take care.
The book again is called Alzheimer's Disease, What If There Was a Cure? By Dr. Mary Newport. It's published by Basic Health Publications. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Michael Murray about his book, Stress, Anxiety, and Insomnia.
Produced at CFIS-FM in Prince George, Health First is available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Well, Dr. Michael Murray is widely regarded as one of the world's leading authorities on natural medicine. He's the author of a number of different books, including a great one on cancer and diabetes. Dr. Murray, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, your new latest book, Stress, Anxiety, and Insomnia, What the Drug Companies Won't Tell You and What Your Doctor Doesn't Know, The Natural Solutions That Can Change Your Life, is really a fascinating book, and probably one that is very timely, as there's a fairly high percentage of people that are suffering from stress, anxiety, and insomnia in North America today.
No question.
What is it, why is it that that you felt that this book was necessary?
Oh, boy, there's so much that people don't realize when they go in to see their doctor about these complaints. They go to the doctor thinking the doctor's going to help them, and most often the doctors rely on these drugs, these sedative hypnotic drugs like Valium-type drugs, Ambien, Restoril, Lunesta, and the research is just staggering about how negative these drugs are to our mind and our body. The latest research published by this Dr. Kripke, Daniel Kripke of the University of California, San Diego, shows that these drugs contribute to about 320,000 to a half million premature deaths each year in North America. One out of 10 North Americans are on these drugs to try and help them deal with stress, anxiety, and insomnia. And little do they know that these drugs actually lead to an early death. And I think there's some underlying causes of stress that are largely ignored by the conventional medical institutions, and as a result, they're trying to use these pills as biochemical band-aids, and they end up creating more harm than good. And I just want to get that information out there so that people can start taking steps to deal with these issues in a more rational way.
Well, you say right in the very beginning that, you know, it's not only physicians that are at fault here. You're saying that patients also feed into the problem because they would rather solve their problems with a drug than get to the root of the problem.
That's true as well. You know, we have to take personal responsibility for our lives, the decisions that we make, the lifestyle choices, what we choose to eat, what we choose to focus on. And when we don't take personal responsibility, then we're always looking for a quick and easy fix outside of ourselves, and that doesn't pay off in the long run. We have to deal with these issues, and there are safe and effective ways to reduce stress in our lives, increase our ability to withstand stress, get a good night's sleep, improve our energy levels, feel better about life, be healthier and happier in every way.
Mm. Before we go there, you know, I want to ask you, what are some of the conditions that are linked to excess stress in our lives?
Well, stress is an underlying factor in virtually every health condition, and it certainly worsens every health condition. I like to use the analogy that stress is like straws on a camel's back. We want to eliminate as many of those stressors as we can, but if we don't have a strong system, then eventually our system starts breaking down. So some of the body systems that are really sensitive to stress are immune system, our cardiovascular system, our gastrointestinal system. These are the three areas where stress is a huge factor in most common conditions affecting these systems. So whether it's the irritable bowel syndrome, low immune function, or high blood pressure, stress can definitely play a role.
I mean, there's even some talk that, you know, a good percentage of cancers are stress-related.
Yeah, again, stress creates a response within us that ultimately can weaken our system. The way our body is built to deal with stress is to either get away from it or fight it. With stress, we get activation of our fight or flight response, and the two areas that get activated are our sympathetic nervous system, which controls our heart rate, the blood flow throughout our body, how we can mobilize body processes to escape danger, and also our adrenal glands. And specifically, we get an outflow of adrenaline and cortisol. And long-term stress leads to long-term elevations in cortisol, and that is extremely damaging. It's damaging to every body tissue, particularly our brain, our bones, our muscle, our heart. Excess cortisol is an epidemic, and it's largely a result of poor ability to deal with stress and faulty blood sugar control. Those two kind of go hand in hand, so that's a big focus of the book, is helping people stabilize their blood sugar levels.
Yeah, and I'm going to come back to that. But what is the difference between stress and anxiety? Because I think people can identify things that are stressing them out, but what's the difference between that, the two?
Well, yeah, stress is anything that activates this fight or flight response activates our adrenal glands. With anxiety, it's a mood disorder characterized by feelings of intense fear or irritability or worry or dread or anxiety. So it's a little bit different than stress. When we feel stressed out, then